Wow, I can't wait to hear what I have to say. My name is Steve Orr, and I'm an alcoholic. Hey, I want to thank Richard and Wayne. I want to thank Bill and the workshop committee for asking me to do this morning. And really, before starting on our spiritual journey, and actually, I turned to my son, Stephen, when I looked at the program with my name on it, and it says, Sunday Spiritual Renewal Meeting. I said, how long have we had that on there? And he said, many, many years. So sometimes we notice things and sometimes we don't. I want to thank my son, Stephen, for starting me on this path. And our relationship has grown beyond my greatest dreams. I also want to thank my wife, Lynn, in California. Our relationship has really been something unexpected, but at the same time, something that's really been very great for me. We share each of our lives in recovery, and I'm blessed to have her as a companion and confidant. And finally, I'd like to thank all the men that have influenced me in my life. We start with these two men behind me, Bill and Doc. I had the honor of being able to meet them and be able to be guided by them. There are a lot of other men. I want to thank every man in this room that's ever looked at me in the eye and shared with me honestly. Because when you share with me honestly, my life grows. And Richard talked about been doing the sex and sobriety since the first workshop I came to in 1983. And I have grown a lot. I have benefited from all the men that I've been able to see during this time. And finally, I'd like to thank my sponsor and my other mentors, both in California, Georgia, Pennsylvania, where I've lived during my recovery. So let's get started on my spiritual journey. My sobriety date, September the 3rd, 1980. I've been coming to the Atlanta Men's Workshop since the February of 1983. I was up in Toccoa, Georgia. It was cold outside. It's hard to say how cold it was. We are recording this, and I have been given explicit instructions to watch my language, which usually isn't a problem for me. But before I start, I'd like to say the serenity prayer the way I say it. I know there's some man out here that I have something to say to you. I don't know what I'm going to say that you need to hear. I don't know what I'm going to say that I need to hear, but I want to start with a serenity prayer the way I say it each morning. God, grant me the grace to accept with serenity the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I need to change today, and the wisdom to know the difference today, and thy will be done today, not mine. I was born into an alcoholic family. My father was an alcoholic, and we found out real quick that when he was in blackouts making threats, and fortunately he was not physically violent, but he's certainly emotionally abusive to us. When I was 15 years old, I made a decision. When my father was in treatment, I was told by a doctor that was taking care of him that if I drank alcohol, I'd probably become an alcoholic. And so I made a decision when I was 15 years old that I was not going to drink alcohol. And after hearing some of our speakers today, I know which direction I'd have gone if I'd have started drinking alcohol in my teen years. But I did not drink alcohol. I also made another decision. I made a decision I wanted to become a medical doctor because I felt if I became a medical doctor, I would feel okay inside of me. And so for the next 10 years, I was focused on becoming a medical doctor and not drinking. And I was able to achieve both of those things. On June the 10th, 1963, I graduated from Emory University Medical School. And I remember very distinctly walking across the stage, getting that diploma, walking back to my seat, and I was so disappointed because I did not feel okay. So I did what a lot of us do. You know, I'd say, well, maybe I'll be okay when I get somewhere else, you know, when my son is born, when I get through my internship. I was always chasing that feeling okay. Because part of my story also is when I was 15, 16, I was seduced by the minister of music at our Baptist church. And up until that time, I'd been pretty active in the church, and I had felt like I had some faith, some confidence that there was some power out there that was going to give me direction. But after that experience, it really impacted me in three different ways. One way, of course, it separated. This was the first man I'd ever shared honestly with, about anything with. So I lost the trust of men. I lost the trust of anybody. I lost the trust of any higher power. Also, it made me wonder whether I was gay or not. I found out I wasn't. But from age 15 to age 41, when I came into the Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not share anything honest with anybody. I went to school, I did well, had acquaintances, I was married, but I felt less than. I did not feel a part of anything, really. And to fast forward a little bit, in about 5 years after I'd graduated from medical school, I was still not feeling okay. I was in a marriage that I wanted to get out of, and I experienced what I now call the pain of living. They really don't talk about the pain of living very any in medical school, at least when I was there. Everybody in this room knows what I'm talking about when I talk about the pain of living. It's a pain of experiencing life, especially if you're trying to do it by yourself. And I started using narcotics that I stole at the hospital and quickly became addicted to the narcotics, and quickly, not too long after that, actually lost my job and started on my addiction journey. In 1971, I had actually finished my OBGYN residency. I was in practice in Atlanta down in Jonesboro, but came knocking on the door of the state inspectors and the DEA people. They came in, took my license off the wall, took my DEA certificate, and gave me an option. You know, you can go into treatment or you can go to jail. And it took me a little while to figure out which one I wanted to do. Y'all understand that question. But I just, you know, in 1972, there weren't very many places treating drug addiction in the United States. Weren't too many places treating alcoholism. But I ended up doing some research and actually went to Lexington, Kentucky. The Public Health Service had a hospital up there. They had one there and one in Fort Worth. And I spent 6.5 months in Lexington, Kentucky. At that time, Nixon was president. They were trying to find a cure for drug addiction, and I had all kind of therapy up there. I had milieu therapy, work therapy, occupational therapy, but I did not hear about or see a 12-step program during that time. I know before and after I was there, they had some 12-step recovery programs. I came out and was actually in an aftercare program for 2 years, and decided maybe drinking wasn't so bad after all. You know, it was legal. It wouldn't make me lose my license again, which I was able to get back. And so from 1974 until 1979, I do what I call the Titanic Shuffle. You know, I need to move around for this one, so I'm going to turn on this speaker a second. So I was saying what I was doing. I thought I had complete control over my usage of drugs. You know, I would drink alcohol until people around me worried about how much I was drinking and the problems I'd get into. I only had one DUI. I deserved a lot more. When stuff started happening, I'd quit the alcohol, and I'd go over and start using narcotics or pills or whatever. And I thought I had complete control because I could quit anytime I wanted to. Of course, I couldn't quit everything anytime I wanted to, but I could quit and change seats in a sinking ship. And same seat. I thought I had control, but I didn't. In the summer of 1979, my son looked at me in the face and told me how he was feeling when I was being verbally abusive in blackouts. And that got my attention because I had become what I said I was not going to become. I had become a drunken father. He was abusive to his children. And that got my attention. He doesn't remember it, but maybe he was in a blackout then. I don't know. But because of that, you know, I made a commitment that I would go into treatment and that I would seek recovery. Now, I entered Ridgeview in September of 1979, and went through their program. They had a three-month program. But I approached recovery about the way I'd approached some of my Boy Scout merit badges, you know, trying to find out what I'd already done that I'd get credit for so I wouldn't have to do it again. And so I didn't get a sponsor, but I went to a lot of meetings. You know, we'll hear people say that meeting makers make it. Well, I made it for 6 months, but that was all I could make it because I didn't get me a sponsor. I didn't work the steps, but I went to a lot of meetings and ended up relapsing, and that relapse lasted for 6 months. And today I'm extremely, extremely grateful for that relapse because when I continued to go to meetings even during the relapse. In fact, you know, I'd go to a meeting and say, well, tonight I'm going to pick up a white chip. Then I'd see Richard or somebody across the room. I said, well, he'll tell them. I was in a program where if you relapsed, they'd send you to Mississippi. You know, Mississippi was kind of the Siberia for the treatment program. And everybody's got to have some Siberia somewhere. And so I'd sit through AA meetings thinking about, you know, that's the problem with the meetings here. You in the Southeast, you give out the chips at the end of the meeting. It's one thing I found out in California, they give out chips or they ask at the beginning of the meeting, and that doesn't give you a chance to change your mind quite as much. But ended up continuing to go to meetings for 6 months, and after I was confronted about why I wasn't going to have a birthday, I wasn't able to lie to my wife and to the counselor. Some of y'all know Donnie Brown, and it's kind of hard to lie to Donnie. But I was able to, you know, I made a commitment to pick up a white chip, and on September the 3rd, 1980, I went to Napa to pick up a chip at 8 o'clock and got called out to go deliver a baby. But I went. Fortunately, they had an 11 o'clock meeting there that night, and I went back and picked up my last white chip that night. At this time, I really had, I knew the program worked. 'Cause if you go to meetings for a year and pay attention at all, you'll see people changing. You'll see people making progress in the program. So I knew the program worked. I just didn't think it would work for me. The honest thing was I hadn't worked the program. I hadn't had a sponsor. I hadn't done the steps. So that first week, I got me a sponsor. I started working the steps. I actually did my first fourth and fifth step in September of 1980. And my sponsor at the time was doing the fourth and fifth step every year. And so I did that for the next 9 years. I did a fourth and fifth step. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what the steps meant to me as we go along. But I'm very grateful for that relapse because of that, because for the past 34 years, I have continued to practice the program because I know with the direction I'll go in if I'm not practicing the steps in this program. When I got to step three, you know, I'm a smart guy. You know, I wanted to know what the fine print on step three was. I asked the same question that our speaker last night asked, you know, what does God want me to do? You know, he might want me to be a missionary to Africa, and you know, I wasn't sure I wanted to do that. But my sponsor, Fred Roten, he looked at me and he said, Steve, I don't know what God has in mind for you, but since you're in AA, maybe it's to not drink. And I thought, well, yeah, that makes sense. And so really, he said, the only step three is just making a decision you're not going to drink. That's all it is. And so, but then the next thing is, well, how do you not drink in AA? Well, it's called steps 4 through 12. So for me, step three is just making a decision. I'm going to do step four. That's all it is. But, you know, also, you know, Fred told me, he said, you know, from the very first week, he told me, you know, when you go home tonight, you get on your knees and thank God for keeping you clean and sober. In the morning when you wake up, you get on your knees and ask God to help you stay clean and sober for this day. And I started arguing with him about I didn't believe in God, etc. And he said, it doesn't make any difference. It doesn't make a difference what you believe, just do it. And at that time and to this day, my God is a group of drunks. G-O-D, a group of drunks. I'd also offer you good orderly direction. Or even somebody recently is a great outdoors. And I don't know how praying to a group of drunks can keep you sober, but it will. It has for me. Now, I think that's the key. It's not what we believe. It's what we do that's important. So I started doing that. And this morning when I woke up, I got on my knees and asked God to help me stay clean and sober today. I say the Serenity Prayer the way I said it a few minutes ago, because I do ask for, you know, for God to show me some direction. I have up here on the table my kit of spiritual tools that I brought along with me. You know, the book says we'll have a kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. I've heard some people say the only thing they do is stumble over that kit. Of course, the primary one is our books. Our books and literature that help show us the path. But I just mentioned the first spiritual tool I was given by my sponsor. That's prayer. Asking for help. And the second spiritual tool really is, my higher power. I heard somebody say at a meeting, you know, this kit, spiritual tools, these are really power tools. You need a power to turn to plug them into. They work a lot better that way. And that's the direction I've been going in. I want to talk just another spiritual. I'm wearing this so I don't hit that, but I'm hitting this. But another spiritual tool I was giving is living one day at a time. You know, I got me a meditation book, and I imagine a lot of y'all have this meditation book but haven't really read the little poem in the front of it. It's a Sanskrit proverb. I want to read that now. Look to this day, for it is life, the very life of life. In its brief course lies all the realities and varieties of existence, the bliss of growth, the splendor of action, the glory of power. For yesterday is but a dream, and tomorrow is only a vision. But today well lived makes every yesterday a dream of happiness, and tomorrow a vision of hope. Look well for to this day. And I think for me, if I can learn to not drink one day at a time, and especially start living one day at a time, then there's so much freedom in that. I like to also, when my son was in treatment in 1985, and I attended a family kind of educational program to explain to the family what AA was about. I went, I was sitting there, and this man got up and he said, "If you really, really, really believe in step one, that we're powerless over alcohol, this means you're not guilty." And think about it for a minute. If you're powerless over something, how can you be guilty of it? For the first time in my life, I felt not guilty for my father's alcoholism. For the first time in my life, I felt not guilty for my son's alcoholism. The first time in my life, I felt not guilty for my alcoholism. I'm responsible for my recovery, but I'm not guilty for being an alcoholic. Now, you know, I managed not to drink for a while, and I didn't become an alcoholic, but you have a potential alcoholic, you put alcohol in, you're going to have an instant alcoholic. And that was me. That was me. So I think that for me, that was a big step to let go of some of the guilt I was feeling about my past. And I think that, you know, the gifts I've been given from the workshop is to realize I'm not alone, because as I began to do my fourth and fifth step, as I began to come to the workshops, I began to share with other men and to get comfortable with who I am. And I remember at one of the workshops, one of the men asked me, well, how do you know when you're healed? How do you know when all this stuff that you've gone through, you're healed from it? And Noel Burtonshaw, who used to do a tremendous job on the Sunday mornings up here, the next day gave me the answer. And that is, when you can reveal yourself without shame, when you can reveal yourself without shame, you know you're healed. And I know it's possible to be healed from anything. It may take time. It may take a lot of time. But by being able to express yourself and reveal yourself without shame, there's such a blessing in that. Such a tremendous blessing. Let's see what else I've got in my box over here. Oh, tapes. CD tapes. This one happens to be Sandy Beach. Somebody gave me a set of Sandy's tapes when I was the first week sober. And it was very dangerous for me being in my car alone. There's too many voices in there. So I put Sandy's step tapes in my tape recorder in the car, and when I turned the car on, the tapes came on. And for 22 years, I had a recovery tape in my car going on. After 22 years, I thought, well, maybe I can leave it off. And I don't do it quite as often now, but I still have recovery tapes that I listen to, because at least when I'm listening to recovery tape, then I'm don't have as much noise. I don't have as much self-conversation. Tell you something else that's important is a phone and phone list. If your group doesn't have a phone list, I'd suggest get one. This is my phone list. My home group's at Mount Soledad Men's in San Diego, and also the Robber's Roost up in Vista, California. And there's some men that we actually have our birthdays on here also. But the phone can be a salvation. And it's amazing how the biggest thing is to get in the habit of using these tools, and don't wait till you need them, but use them on a regular basis. When somebody asked me to be their sponsor, I asked them to start to call me every day for the first month at least, and sometimes even longer. Other thing is, I like to spend time with the people I sponsor. I sponsor about 7 men out in California now, and we spend at least an hour a day away from a meeting, just us talking eyeball to eyeball and sharing our experiences. And that way things don't have time to build up. I've done a lot of moving in recovery. You know, I've actually left Atlanta in 1988, went to California for a couple of years, and then Pennsylvania and back. And I find a spiritual tool that I was given, and that is doing 90 meetings in 90 days. And I think whenever I've moved or really had crises develop in my life, I've done 90 meetings in 90 days. And you can't live for 34 years without crises happening in your life. During this 34 years, both my parents have died. I have a younger brother who died from brain cancer 3 or 4 years ago. The mother of Steve's, his mother died from lung cancer a few years ago. But by reaching out and being with other men, I've been able to live through that and not use or drink. You know, you sometimes hear people say, well, God doesn't give you more than you can handle. Well, page two of Paul Harvey's part is he doesn't give you more than you can handle with help. But by yourself, by myself, there are lots of things I can't handle. But if I reach out and tell you I have a problem, I tell you, have you have any experience with this, then you can help me. We together can walk through whatever we need to walk through, no matter what it is. And I think that's part of the solution with that. Let's see if I have anything else over here. Oh, I just got some more books, meditation books. And I think for me, that asking for help, and I need a sponsor more now than I did when I came in. And I have a sponsor in California, and I spend an hour and a half with him every Monday morning and just sharing with him what's going on in my world. I'd like to mention the third time I did a fourth and fifth step, I did what I call my professional fourth step. If any of you are having trouble with your profession, really know what's going on, I did a fourth step inventory looking at how my education and practice had been affected by my addiction and character defects. And I took that with another physician, and that was the first time I really felt okay as a physician. I'd always felt less than, always felt like a third-year medical student, that just a question of how long it's going to take before somebody finds out what I don't know. But that gave me a feeling of, I didn't know any more than I knew before, but instead of focusing on what I didn't know, I focused on what I did know. I'd like to talk a little bit about the 10th step. I was told by my sponsor I could start doing the 10th step the first week. And that probably changed my behavior as much as anything else, because when I start, I got tired of making amends. So he says, it doesn't say if we're wrong, it says when we're wrong. But I found that by changing my behavior a little bit, I didn't have to make as many amends. I had trouble sleeping at first because I'd go home and do my 10th step inventory right before I'd go to sleep. And I couldn't go to sleep. I was thinking about all this stuff that happened that day. So I started, whenever there's a problem, the answer is to talk to your sponsor about it. What's going on? And my sponsor suggested, well, why don't you wait, start your inventory when you leave work? So I did. When I left work, I would start doing my inventory for that day, for the more or less my work inventory. By the time I got home, I'd be finished with it. And that accomplished two things. One, I could sleep better, but also it meant I was at home. I wasn't sitting at home worrying about what had happened at work. I was able to be more of a husband, more present with the home situation. I'd like to talk about the 14th year. Our speaker Friday night talked about his 14th year, and it's any of y'all have in the 14th year, you may not want to listen to this, but my 14th year, I was living up in Pennsylvania. I was coming down to the workshops in March, and the dogwoods and azaleas would be in bloom. Go back up there and not even see anything green for 2 months. And I don't know what a Georgia boy was doing up in Pennsylvania, but I finally realized that wasn't where I needed to be. So I started looking for jobs. I returned from a job interview it was right after the workshop, probably in March, and fell on some ice and broke two ribs. Developed pneumonia 2 months later. Had gotten a job offer in Atlanta, so I had to. I was too weak from the pneumonia to even pack up my house. Actually, two of my sons came and helped pack up the house. Moved from Pennsylvania to Atlanta. Thought I had a job, and found out then that I wasn't going to be able to get on the hospital staff at Piedmont Hospital because of some wreckage of the past, at least prejudices of the past. So I'd already bought a house in Stone Mountain, Georgia. So here I own two houses, didn't have a job. and started looking for a job. I spent 9 months looking for a job, and I kept getting, you know, problem was I had three strikes against me already. One, I was old. I'm older now, but I was old. Two, I was a male in a specialty that was being started to be dominated by women. And three, I had a history of drug addiction and alcoholism. And I learned real quick, you know, you don't lead off with your chin. You don't start off telling them, you know, they knew I was a male. I mean, I wasn't able to hide that. But, you know, I'd wait to the second interview before I tell them about my drug addiction and alcoholism. And they would say, oh, that's all right. We don't have a problem with that. And the next day they call you up. Well, we've been thinking. Aunt Susie or somebody didn't like the idea. But so I spent 9 months looking for a house. And fortunately, I had good credit cards. Living off my credit cards, paying these houses I was trying to sell. And then in April of 1995, I guess it wasn't too long after the workshop, I really had got very close to losing any faith or hope. You know, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. My credit cards were starting to get maxed out. And I did a lot of praying. I went to a lot of meetings. And then within a 10-day period, I had five job offers, any one of which, if I had gotten it the month before, I'd have said, thank you, God, let's go. And all of a sudden, I had to make a blankety-blank decision. You know, that's the way my higher power works. Still throw stuff back in my lap. And I ended up going to Carrollton, Georgia after that decision. I won't get into the details of it, but I told Rick Martin, my partner out there, his higher power had sent for me and then asked for my permission because he was recovering. It was 18 months out of into recovery. In fact, the local TV station did a expose on him. His stripper girlfriend was suing him for tying her tubes without her permission. in fact, it was on TV the same week. I told him I was going to come out there, and my mother called me up, and she said, Steve, what's the name of that doctor you're going with? And fortunately, Rick had called me and told me about this. I said, Mama, that's the doctor you saw on TV last night, but he did that when he was drinking. He doesn't drink now. She said, okay. She was all right with that. And so I went out there, and that's where I spent the last 12 years of my practice. Moved to California to be close to my only granddaughter, and it's been a great move since we've been out there. You know, it's amazing sometimes how things come around. I have on the wall of my office today the actual poem that was on my wall when I was 10 years old. And I want to just read that now. This talks about your goal. It shows a little sailboat. Ships sail east and ships sail west while the selfsame breezes blow. It's the set of the sails and not the gales that determine the way they go. Like the winds of the sea are the ways of fate as we journey along through life. It's the set of the soul that determines the goal and not the calm nor the strife. For me, Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps of this program have given me a sense of well-being that I never imagined in my life. I feel good about who I am and what I am today. And I'm very extremely grateful that I have been given this life through this disease that kills so many people. And it saddens me to know that some of the men in this room will die drunk. Some of the men in this room will kill people while they're intoxicated. Each of us have a decision to make. And it gets back to what that decision I talked about was step three. Do I want to stay sober? Do I want to stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous? Do I want to learn how to be a better man, a better father? And if the answer is yes, then stay. You know, we tell people, keep coming back. Don't come back, just stay. Just stay here with us. But we, you hear people, you know, for the newcomers, you know, people will tell you they're going to love you till you can love yourself. Well, I don't, you know, that's kind of hard to do sometimes. But we'll laugh at you till you can laugh at yourself. And when you can start laughing at yourself and laughing at who you are and what you are, then you know you've begun the journey. You begin to go in a direction away from that isolated feeling of aloneness that when I first came into AA, I felt so terminally unique and so alone, and I didn't have anybody I could share with. And today it's come full circle. You know, there's not a man in this room I can't look in the eye and talk to you about whatever's going on, listen to you, and be present for you. Be present for you. And if you don't have this back where you're going today, find it. It's there. And I wish everyone here that you'll be able to die sober. Thank you.